Here's a book publishing riddle for 2012. When is a book not good for a bookstore? Andrew Albanese has the answer for us. And in reviews, Adam Boritz has word on a comics title that's an evocative throwback to the superheroes of yore. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, host of Beyond the Book. And every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that has everyone in publishing talking. Joining me from PW's New York office, this is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor, and welcome back, Andrew.
Hey, Chris.
It's good to have you back with us. Of course, we did take some time off for the 4th of July. That was a nice little break. There were some fireworks, but not the usual kind. Tell us about those.
Well, it's good to be back. And you're right. There were some fireworks over the 4th of July involving the usual suspects. You know, there's Amazon, book scanning lawsuits, the Department of Justice, all those good things. First thing I'll mention is that Monday's issue is our children's announcements issue. So that's always a big one for us. So we know you want to tune in for that. But let me get right to the fireworks. And the first story I want to talk about is the Amazon story. Now, you'll recall earlier this year that Amazon had entered into an arrangement with Houghton Mifflin to sell Amazon's new harvest, new imprint called New Harvest. Well, independent bricks and mortar booksellers, as well as the nation's two largest chains, Barnes & Noble and Books A Million, all said they were not going to carry Amazon titles in their stores. Well, the first two books of the new Harvest imprint are about to ship, and our Judith Rosen reached out to booksellers last week and asked them what they were going to do, and they've doubled down. No, indeed, they are not going to be carrying Amazon books in their bookstores. You know, and frankly, it's hard not to say some of these stores are not justified in their decision not to want to carry Amazon books. You have the Department of Justice case, you have Amazon's lock-in on ebooks, and Amazon as, you know, shall we say, a voracious competitor. That's a nice way to put it, I guess.
Right. And hence my riddle at the top of the show there. When is a book not good enough for a bookstore? When it's an Amazon book.
It's an Amazon book.
And we are now entering a world where Amazon's a publisher as well as kind of a bookstore. So this is really taking an interesting twist.
It's taking a very interesting twist. And I have to say, this decision comes at a cost. You know, not carrying these books it's bad for the authors of those books. It's bad for readers who want those books. It's even bad for the bookstores that are not carrying them because they're losing potential sales. And frankly, for businesses like bookstores that stand so admirably for free expression, it's kind of disappointing. It's bad PR for the bookstores. And at the end of the day, what does it really achieve besides driving customers who want these books to buy it from, you got it, you know, Amazon? So, you know, I understand the compulsion not to carry these books, and I understand the threat from Amazon. Believe me, we see it all the time here at PW. And I certainly don't have any easy answers to what to do about this one, but I will say that I hope that the bookselling community, as they wrestle with this, will at least have some sort of cogent communication to the issues here with their customers, that there's going to be space for feedback on this, and that, you know, this whole issue might turn into, you know, as they say, a teachable moment. My wife and I were talking about this, you know, just the other night. And, you know, frankly, I think selling the titles creates a better opportunity to engage customers on the issues rather than not selling the titles. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example, and it involves fish. When I go to my local fishmonger now, he includes information on where the fish comes from and its sustainability. Now, he does not sell the fish that are unsustainable and in danger because he knows the customers who want those fish are just going to walk down to the store down the street and get it anyway, or go to the supermarket and get it. But he uses placards and he educates me about my choices. And I can tell you that I'm much less likely, and my wife absolutely will not buy fish that is not sustainable. So maybe that's a model that could work for bookstores here. You know, maybe you have a display of New Harvest titles, or maybe you put a placard next to an Amazon book with a note about sustainable publishing. You know, you can get this book if you really want it, but here's what you need to know about the environment. And I think book buyers might appreciate that.
Well, yeah, but I'm not sure that book publishers want to be compared to fish, though.
Well, probably not.
And besides that, the fish can't talk back when your fishmonger says where they came from and whether they're sustainable.
But it's not a perfect example.
I like the point. I think the educating piece is critical here. And I believe that many book consumers, readers we used to call them, are being educated sort of, you know, dragging into it because so much of the reporting that's taking place that you're doing, that we're reading about in the New York Times and elsewhere about the DOJ case and so many others, are giving people a glimpse of the book publishing business that they probably never had before.
Well, I think there's no better place for a book lover to learn about what's going on in the book industry than in a bookstore. And I think this is an opportunity to provide that education.
Well, I like the idea. But, you know, it's all about the tenuous state of publishing, unfortunately, and much of that's going to wind up in court. And there have been some legal developments since we last spoke, and more to come in the following week. So let's start with the Author Guild suit against Haiti Trust.
That's right. So, you know, it turns out I spent my 4th of July holiday digging into motions for summary judgment filed in that case, the Authors Guild versus the Haiti Trust. And you know, it was a quick refresher. Motions for summary judgment pretty much lay out the case for each side. And with these motions, each side is asking the judge to rule for them without a trial. In other words, you know, their cases are so strong and so legally sound that the judge should just spare everyone the pain and expense and rule for them right now. Of course, that's probably not going to happen. You know, as you might imagine, these copyright cases, you know, especially a case as big as this one, can be pretty intricate. But, you know, it has happened in the past. For example, in 2010, Google won a summary judgment motion in the Viacom case. That decision, of course, was reversed on appeal, and they are going to go back to trial. So, you know, you get the point. It's a little tough. But I'll catch you up on the Authors Guild and Haiti Trust stuff. I know the broad strokes of what they've argued, and you know, I'll get right to the point. The Authors Guild really kind of ramped up the rhetoric against libraries here, basically saying that the discovery process that's been going on for the past few months has only reinforced how brazen a plan this whole library effort has been. The AG is resting its case heavily on an argument that nothing in Section 108 of the Copyright Act, which is known as the library exemption, authorizes mass digitization. And in fact, the libraries exceed Section 108 in some very explicit ways. Now, this is basically the same case that the Authors Guild made in February when it filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which, interestingly enough, the court has not yet ruled on. But the AG brief also addressed the fair use issue, not in as much detail as its 108 argument. But basically, they said, hey, if you need to do a fair use analysis, we don't think you do, but if you do, guess what? Not fair use. Now, the Haiti Trust motion, on the other hand, for summary judgment, relies almost entirely on fair use and barely touches on the Section 108 argument. So all four factors of the fair use case, the libraries argue, favor them or tilt in their direction. And with discovery now complete, the Authors Guild said that the case fails to show any real harm suffered here by the plaintiffs, only prospective harms, that no one has lost any sales, no books have been pirated, no licensing revenue has been taken away because there is no license-based market that exists for preservation copies, which is what the Haiti Trust is doing here. And almost certainly there never will be a license-based preservation business. In fact, the libraries present evidence that the Haiti Trust database has actually generated sales because researchers have now found books otherwise lost in the stacks via keyword searches, and then in some cases, those books were actually purchased. So you know, there's a point I want to make clear here. The Haiti Trust, though it was built with scans from the Google Book Search project, it's not Google Book Search. There's no display of any copyrighted material. There's no snippets. There's nothing. There's just a page number that comes up when you do a search, unless you are certified print disabled, and then you can get access to the book. So given the program's benefits to researchers and benefits to the disabled and the lack of any demonstrable harm and the benefit to copyright holders, they actually make some sales out of this. Who needs a trial, the libraries argue? They should win their case open and shut. This is fair use. Now, next week, as you mentioned, this all continues. Each side is going to file its opposition briefs to the court, which is going to essentially tear down the other's case for summary judgment. Those briefs are due on July 20th. So yes, I'll be working next weekend reading through those briefs. And then the replies to the opposition brief come after that on July 27th. So yeah, no weekends at all for me this summer, it looks like. And also on July 27th, it's worth noting that the summary judgment motions in the Authors Guild versus Google case, the case that started it all back in 2005, they're also due on July 27th.
You mean that case is still going on? Well, of course it is. And I suppose you might wish for, you know, to help you out with that reading, that it was all just one single case. But in fact, we do have two separate and very important cases. But as you're going to tell us, there's a certain potential convergence here. What's going on?
Yeah, this is where it's going to really get fun. And I don't mean fun as in fun, but interesting fun. You know, barring an unlikely quick victory by one side or another at the summary judgment stage, a trial in the HathiTrust case could begin in Judge Harold Baer's Manhattan courtroom just a few weeks after the Authors Guild versus Google trial, which is set for October 9th, is going to be heard in Judge Chin's courtroom. Again, this is all barring a summary judgment win by one party or another here. But what we're set up for is a fascinating scenario in which we have two judges in the same district who are going to simultaneously decide two separate cases involving the same plaintiff, both involving Google, and both involving virtually the same digitization behavior. Now, you may recall that initially the HathiTrust case was referred to Judge Chin, but Judge Chin had decided to decline the case as not related. In reality, these cases could not be more related. But you'll also recall that Judge Chin had been promoted to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and he was only sitting by designation to the district court on the Google case, you know, as well as in a parallel case involving visual artists who are also suing Google. So clearly, he was not eager to expand his district court assignments while already at work at the appellate level. That was like a little wrinkle at the time, Chin's promotion to the appeals court. It really wasn't seen as a big deal, just kind of a curious thing. But that little wrinkle has now created a very tantalizing nugget of possibility that these two judges might rule differently on fundamentally identical issues. Now, a decision by one does not bind the other, but all my legal sources tell me the decision by one judge could certainly influence the other judge not to reach the issues in their case. So a key question in this Google saga now is which judge will rule first. And there are even more wrinkles. As you know, Google has appealed Judge Chin's recent decision to certify the case as a class action, so the appeal could throw that up in the air. And in the HathiTrust case, Judge Baer has yet to rule on a HathiTrust motion challenging the Authors Guild's associational standing. And that was filed back in December of 2011. So he could still ostensibly potentially knock out the Authors Guild claim too. So, you know, crazy stuff going on here. And meanwhile, there's one party that's missing out from all this fun.
And that's your riddle to me. And I guess
you know who that is.
And it's right. I know the answer. It's the publishers.
It's the publishers. You know, you'll recall that the publishers also still have a lawsuit here, supposedly. In September of last year, they agreed to the trial schedule, but said, hey, it's not going to matter because we're very close to a settlement with Google. Google said the same thing. Well, it's closing in on a year now, and we still don't have that settlement. So at the very least, it looks like everyone's sitting back and letting the Authors Guild carry the litigation weight here. And I'm beginning to wonder at what point the publishers are going to have to stand up and fight, drop the suit, or hold their noses and make a deal. And all of those outcomes would have consequences, of course. So there's a piece to this puzzle that's still out there, and it's held by the publishers.
Well, certainly one thing publishers have been busy with is the case involving price fixing in the Department of Justice. So I understand there's a flood of comments to the court over the proposed settlement.
That's another case that's heating up over the summer. It's going to be very busy. And yeah, there have been a flood of comments coming in. Apparently, there's been over 800 comments that were filed with the court about the settlement the Department of Justice made with three publishers to sort of make their price fixing charges go away. Now, apparently, the Department of Justice is finally going to publish those all those comments a week late, actually a little more than a week late, but they all are supposed to be online by the 20th of July. So we're hoping they start going up even before then next week. So look for that. Next week, we're going to be parsing through comments on the Department of Justice settlement with publishers for price fixing. It's going to be a busy summer, Chris.
Yeah, it's not the summer reading that you and I might have preferred to be doing. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, thank you so much for the wrap-up of the news.
Thank you.
And now we're going to turn this week for our review of reviews to Adam Boritz, PW Reviews Editor, who joins us for the first time on the show. Adam, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we look forward to your take on the review of reviews, and let's start out with some mysteries. What's new there?
Well, in the mystery thriller department, we have Chase Novak's Breed, a timely medical thriller in which a wealthy Manhattan couple, desperate for children, consult a fertility specialist in remote Slovenia. They produce boy-girl twins, but the side effects are nothing to write home about. Novak is a pseudonym for Scott Spencer, author of Endless Love. We've also got a new title from Edgar Award winner Laura Lippman. Our reviewer says Lippman excels at writing powerful tales about complex women who tackle desperate choices, as shown in her seventh standalone, And When She Was Good, about a suburban Maryland woman's double life as a madam. This is a gripping tale about the consequences of long-buried secrets, misogyny, motherhood, and morality. And we've got a Q&A with Spencer Quinn, author of A Fistful of Collars, the fifth mystery about P.I. Bernie Little and his canine companion Chet, who narrates the action and, as the author stresses, is, quote, not a talking dog, not a human in a dog suit.
So Adam, in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror category, we've got a tale of small town life that kind of goes astray.
That's right. That's The Narrows. And our reviewer says Ronald Malfi brings a cinematic vividness to this story of a dying small town, the fate of which manifests as a nightmare of supernatural horror. Industrial town Stillwater, Maryland, is in the final throes of its decline when it's plagued by a series of weird incidents. Hordes of bats start appearing, several young boys go missing, and townsfolk begin seeing phantoms from their past. Our reviewer said, this smartly written novel succeeds as both an allegory of small-town life and a tale of visceral horror. And our reviewer called Mark Everett Stone's The Judas Line a, quote, delightful Catholicism-infused quest fantasy starring a likable and original duo, Father Michael Engel, a pragmatic Roman Catholic priest, and Jude, who has a considerably more uncertain relationship with God, are unlikely friends. But when a blood-covered Jude runs into Mike's church asking for help, Mike listens to him, believes him, and joins him on a quest to find the Holy Grail. Our reviewer said, Stone's depiction of magic is realistic and intelligent, and his treatment of Catholicism refreshingly informed, three-dimensional.
And in romance, we have a story of a girl named Brady.
Well, that's right. We have two reviews of Regency-era romances that put new spins on familiar characters. Eloisa James retells The Ugly Duckling as The Ugly Duchess. The review says, James' patented clever dialogue and complex characters make the unusual situation completely believable from a setup to denouement. And, as you were saying, Kieran Kramer turns the Brady Bunch into the House of Brady with loving Lady Marcia. Our reviewer said, though Kramer includes her characteristic lighthearted touches, she's smart and confident enough to take her characters and their situations seriously, turning what could have been a one-line joke into a deep and appealing story.
Well, Comic-Con is getting underway just now, and in comics, what have we got there?
In Moyoko Ano's Sarakan, Blossoms Wild, Kyoha is sold to a brothel as a child maid, but eventually becomes a powerful courtesan. Although described as her story, this book is more a collection of incidents that reveal her prickly personality, understandable given her history. Our reviewer said, the demanding book rewards attention and is not for new readers, best for those experienced with the format seeking something a bit out of the ordinary for adults. In God and Science, The Return of Tie Girls, Jamie Hernandez fuses the spirit of Silver Age superhero comics with the ongoing soap opera of Maggie, the former mechanic now turned manager of a shabby Southern California apartment complex. Our reviewer said, for what's essentially an evocative throwback to the kids' superhero comics of yore, there's a lot going on here. Youth versus seasoned oldsters, absolute power corrupting absolutely, mother-child dysfunction, and it's all wrapped up in a package of terrific dialogue, stellar artwork, and enough raw fun to drown it.
And there's a new book out that's probably got quite a buzz going.
Indeed it does. That would be Les Crowder and Heather Harrell work on starting a buzz for a different method of beekeeping known as top bar beekeeping. In their book, Top Bar Beekeeping, Organic Practices for Honeybee Health, they argue the advantages of this method. It avoids antibiotics, miticides, and other chemicals inherent to the conventional process. Even if you're uninterested in beekeeping, you may be interested in eating better honey. What a sweet idea.
Indeed. And something also sweet is the children's section. And what kind of picture books are you reviewing this week?
Well, in the picture book section, we've got reviews of new books from Patrick McDonald of Mutt's fame, Nancy Tillman, Helen Ward, and Mem Fox. As for fiction, there's the triumphant return of Dav Pilkey's Captain Underpants, who is back in his ninth adventure. Other big fall books include Sharon Creech's The Great Unexpected, Ellis Wiener's The Templeton Twins Have an Idea, and Jessica Corey's Origin. We're also running a roundup of dinosaur-themed books, because, hey, who doesn't love dinosaurs? As well as a grouping of story collections that include Mother Goose rhymes, Edward Lear poems, Carlo Collodi's Pinocchio, and tales from ancient India presented in a comic book-style format.
Well, Adam Boritz, let's turn now to adult nonfiction, and there's a title about Native American activists.
That's right. In This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made, historian Frederick E. Hoxie profiles 8 Native American lawyers, lobbyists, writers, and politicians from the early 19th to late 20th century who chose to oppose the oppressions of the United States with words and ideas rather than violence. PW calls it an important, well-written, and thoroughly documented work about Native American leaders who, while lesser known, are no less important. And in the provocative and noteworthy collection Colors of Confinement, rare Kodachrome photographs of Japanese-American incarceration in World War II, legal scholar Eric L. Mueller presents 65 photographs made from slides that were taken by photographer Bill Manbo, a Japanese-American interned at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in Wyoming during World War II. Manbo was active in the camp's photo club and shot not just the traditional views of bleakly uniformed buildings, but parades, pastimes, cultural rituals, and many family portraits.
That sounds like a book worth checking out. It seems to me that when everyone sees color photography from the Second World War, it makes it so much more lifelike and therefore so much more touching. In the annex, there's a star review.
That's right. In Prince William, the Man Who Will Be King, Penny Jr. focuses on the life of the eldest son of the Prince of Wales, detailing his gilded childhood, his parents' troubled marriage, his coming of age, and, of course, his courtship and wedding to Kate in 2011. Having reported on and worked closely with the royal family for 30 years, Junior is privy to plenty of drama, but this bio comprises more than just dirt and hearsay. She sheds light on the day-to-day ordeals that try a family and a man, royal or not. And we have another starred review. In Santiago Gamboa's Necropolis, a nameless working writer attends the International Conference on Biography and Memory in Jerusalem, only to find himself investigating the sudden death of charismatic conference speaker Jose Maturano. Our reviewer says Gamboa's work calls to mind Roberto Bolaño in its masterful suspense, complex literary references, and frank depictions of violence, sex, and drugs. But this novel stands on its own as a masterwork of storytelling.
And finally, Adam, in the pick of the week, we have the story of a successful sequel, which is a rarity.
That's right. It's Return to the Willows by Jacqueline Kelly, illustrated by Clint Young. And in the sequel to Kenneth Graham's 1908 classic, The Wind in the Willows, Kelly supplies a boatload of mayhem and mishaps for Mr. Toad and company. Tired of messing about in boats and stealing motor cars, Toad sets his sights skyward with predictably disastrous results. A crash, a head injury, and a daring expedition to recover a lost aircraft culminate in a battle waged with birthday cake and baguettes. Our reviewer says, while Kelly's story is more plot-driven than the original, she evokes an old-fashioned feel by retaining the original's Britishisms, translated for American readers with explanatory footnotes. Young's artwork captures both the comedic aspects of the cast and the serenity of the natural world in which they wreak their havoc. It's an affectionate follow-up to a classic of children's literature, one that succeeds on its own as a humorous and adventurous romp along the riverbank and into the wild wood.
A place that's always a pleasure to go. Adam Boritz, reviews editor for PW, thanks so much for bringing us this week's reviews.
Well, thanks for having me.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.